Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.
Welcome to the ninth episode of the Brandel Chamblee podcast with Jaime Diaz. I'm Jaime Diaz. Brandel, congratulations.
Nice to be here.
Once again for the good play on the PGA Tour champions. And today you had a nice match, I understand.
I did. I played a little golf today with our producer here, Ben Dawn, and Nota Begay, and Rob Oppenheim. And you know, Rob drove it great, for crying out loud. So it's fun to get out there and see what a tour player is capable of these days. And he was like, listen, I'm below average driving distance. I was like, golly, has the game changed. So it was good to see.
Well, we're going to talk about rivalries today, starting with Brooks Koepka and Rory McIlroy, which a lot of people are talking about. And, of course, Brooks sort of controversially said, you know, isn't it really not a rivalry? But before we get to that, let's just talk about some recent developments. First of all, there was the Skins game in Japan, and that was Tiger's first appearance since August. A lot of curiosity about how he looked. And he also said that he had considered having his knee operated on at the end of last year because it was giving him trouble. But then he wanted to play at Torrey Pines, and as a result, he didn't have the knee operation. He won the Masters, of course, but since then, since the Masters, really hadn't played that well, and sort of gave new context to perhaps what the cause of that poor play was. So what did you see with Tiger? What do you project going forward if this knee surgery thing might have been a cure for some of his poor play?
Well, he looked peppier at the Skins game, didn't he? You know, and you know, just watching him on the range warming up, it looked like the speed was back up a little bit. It had fallen down to 114, 115 miles an hour or something. So they didn't have that kind of data really on the range, but it looked to me like his speed was up and he was peppier, and that's good news. You know, little nagging injuries are going to, I think, always be the story with him. You know, he's always had this sort of kinetic chain issue, you know, from Achilles to his knees all the way up to his neck. It's been going on since before 2008 when we really got first wind of all these things. But you can go back and look at the 2007 PGA Championship and see him, which he won.
There was a little buckling
and you can
there.
See him buckling, getting out of bunkers. So who knows how long it's really been going on, but it's the norm with him. And, you know, if I get the feeling that, you know, he's got another few good years left in him, let's hope. And if he does, you know, maybe he can continue to add to his win totals, because look, 82 is still there. It's still just sitting there. And it somehow it would just seem right if he tied or even got one more than Snead. So that's what I'm looking forward to this next year with Tiger.
Yeah, and based on, you know, his play in these last few months, or at least before he stopped playing, I was starting to doubt whether he was capable of winning again. And I think this new information, which he didn't, you know, let on about until just 2 days ago, I think puts a different perspective on things. Nota was mentioning that while Tiger's swing speed has slowed down, last year he definitely, and early this year, he still had an extra gear. He could still get up to 120 when he wanted to. And since he kind of started feeling some pain and his body was breaking down a little because of the knee surgery, knee situation, he had lost that gear and he wasn't pushing that anymore. So, you know, as you've mentioned many times, you know, ball speed, club head speed is really sort of what determines your potential out there. And if he's got more speed, I think that bodes well.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've all learned not to be surprised at what Tiger Woods can put together. Having said that, I think I was more surprised at his post-Masters form, both physically and what we could sort of glean psychologically, emotionally, as I was him winning the Masters.
I agree.
Because I thought he was off and running, and I'd never seen him look so, and you know, I can understand it, look so the word was complacent, really,
yeah,
after his master's victory. But, you know, climbing that mountain, if you can imagine, I mean, any of us to climb that mountain, can you imagine? He never thought he was going to play golf again, first of all. And then he never thought he was going to play like any semblance of what he used to play like. And he did. And he won arguably the biggest event there is in the game of golf, at least in terms of rating. So, you know, it was, I think it was the biggest story of last year, in two ways, him winning and then what he did afterwards. And then, you know, after that, everything else had an interest level that was, you know, somewhere below those two stories.
Yeah.
All roads lead to Tiger Woods, and they'll continue to do so until he hangs it up. It's just the way it is.
Well said. And then, the you know, somewhat related is these knee injury, sort of this new trend, this rash with, you know, some really top players, all power players, Dustin Johnson, Tiger, of course, and Brooks Koepka, who sort of re-injured a patella thing in his left knee. All these are left knee injuries. And I was just curious, Brandel, because you've become much more knowledgeable about training as you've started to play more, and, you know, what is the most efficient way to gain speed, and, you know, through fitness, through strength, through all kinds of new, you know, physical exercises that are being developed. But they might be stressful on the body. I'm just wondering, you don't see a lot of knee injuries historically in golf. You see them with guys who injured themselves different ways. You play with Bill Glasson. He, you know, he had an old football injury, mm-hmm, from high school that never went away. He was constantly having knee surgeries. Andy North had knee surgery, five of them, I think. But it was from a congenital situation from sixth grade. I remember Mark Calcavecchia had an ACL that he did skiing. So I don't recall golf causing the knee injury. I could be off on that. But do you think maybe the style of play now, or also the training, is responsible for this increase in what we're seeing as far as the left knee?
There's two things that are contributing to it, at least in my view. And I've spent a fair bit of time talking to movement specialists and chiropractors and physios about this subject, and I've read quite a bit online about what some of the TPI guys think about movement in the golf swing, what's going on out there. So I come at this with some degree of awareness. The golf swing is restricted for control, and people are in the gym building muscle for power. So you have two things that are just, mm-hmm, not going to work together.
Yeah.
They're just not going to work. If you restrict the golf swing and yet you build muscle for power and you have this and you restrict it, you're then making the golf swing more explosive. Power has to come in a shorter period of time. And so you're not distributing the load of the golf swing over the entire body.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, you're going to have hot spots. And these hot spots are going to be, you know, the lower right side of the body, the lower back part, the lower right hip, if you're a right-handed golfer, is going to be your knees. And we've seen that. I think, you know, the golf swing has to change, or the training has to change. Have you ever seen anybody more out of shape than John Daly, mm-hmm, play golf? I haven't. Have you ever seen anybody less inclined to go to the gym than John Daly? I haven't. John Daly drove the ball longer than Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods was in the gym all the time. Tiger Woods was taller. He was, by all appearances, a better athlete, and he spent time in the gym. And yet John Daly could hit it past him. And John was, you know, massively overweight, massively out of shape. Now, how did he do that? Because, and never hurt. Have you ever heard of John Daly having
a back problem? Well, his knees finally gave up, but that was probably from being overweight.
Okay.
As far as,
But he's 55 years old,
yes,
now.
Yes, yeah.
And he's,
your point's well taken.
50,
and you could add
50 pounds overweight, 60, 70 pounds overweight. He was overweight when he played the tour. He was out of shape. He hit it past Tiger Woods. And he never had a back problem. He never had a knee problem. Now, why is that? Because he did a better job with his golf swing of distributing the load, mm-hmm, throughout the golf swing. When tour players learn, and I think they're slowly getting to this, they saw what Cameron Tregale did this year,
mm-hmm,
picking up 8 miles an hour club head speed by just change. You tell me somebody who went to the gym and picked up 8 miles an hour club,
right,
head speed. It didn't happen with Brooks.
Mm-hmm.
Brooks didn't go to the gym and pick up 8 miles club head speed. Brooks swings slower now than when he first came out on tour. Dustin Johnson swings slower now than when he first came out on tour. Okay, they went to the gym. They didn't pick up club head speed.
Mm-hmm.
Rory McIlroy, when he was in the gym throwing heavy weight around, lost club head speed. incrementally, but he didn't pick it up, and he was in the prime of his life. He's now picked up clubhead speed training a different way. He's gotten longer training a different way. So, you know, when will golfers pay attention to the fact that people think I'm against fitness? Not at all am I against fitness. You absolutely need to have stability to have mobility. So you need to have, you know, you, as it's been explained to me, you're never going to have more mobility than you can stabilize. So yes, you have to go to the gym to do all these things to get your body right, to move in the right way, and to have quickness, and a modicum amount of power. But this muscular metamorphosis that is taking the tour by storm is a waste of time in the gym, and they're not allowing the body to heal. If you're surrounded by a fitness instructor and a swing instructor, and everybody wants their time. I've talked to people out on the tour, the PGA Tour, and you know, that are in charge of all these, you know, training, and it's like they all need their time. Mm-hmm. And they finish, and they need to rest, but somebody wants them in the gym. Mm-hmm. And they need to rest, and somebody wants them to hit balls. And they need to rest, and somebody wants to talk to them about something else. It's like they're surrounded by all of these entourages. And all those people want to justify the payment that they're getting. And to do that, they need time with the player when rest is just as important as anything else out there. I think guys are going to get smarter about it, and they're going to see players picking up speed by better biomechanics.
We're seeing that with Danny Lee, for example.
Yeah, Danny Lee went to George Gankus, and he's picked up quite a bit of clubhead speed. And he did that. And look at Danny. Danny's he's a twig. He's a twig.
I noticed he even had a little paunch. I'm not saying he's not in shape, but he definitely is not a guy who's cut.
Right.
These
are better biomechanics. These are better moves. They're more upright, doing a better job of doing the right things to produce and recruit the right elements of your body to hit it further. I've said it all the time about Bubba Watson.
Right.
I mean, Bubba Watson hits it, well, he's getting closer to 40, right? So he's reached his physiological prime and he's deteriorating physiologically. But when he was 31, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, he hit it further than anybody else out on tour. And again, not a gym rat. Mm-hmm. Not a gym rat. So, you know, going to hit it past Dustin Johnson. He's going to hit it past Brooks Koepka.
And those things he did in his swing are the things that you have been a proponent of, bigger hip turn, more upright, the things that you put in your book, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And look, I mean, Bubba's sort of the upper extremity or lower, depending upon how you do it. If there's a norm, say, of your center of mass, COM, if there's a norm of where that moves in the body, and let's say those players who are just looking for accuracy hang more left if they're a right-handed golfer, hang more on their lead leg, okay? Bubba Watson would hang out more on his right leg. Mm-hmm. You know, he'd move there, and this idea that...
It'd be his left leg.
That's right. Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah, it'd be his, you're right. It'd be his trail leg is what I should say. He'd hang out more on his trail leg. Mm-hmm. This idea that you put 80% of your weight on your rear leg at the top of your backswing and 80% of your weight on your lead leg at impact couldn't be more wrong. It's not right. It's not true. It's not right. You have the load sort of, your weight sort of evenly distributed, but the longest hitters are more 60-40 with the 60 on their trail leg at the top of the backswing and 60-40 with the 60 being on their lead leg at impact. So, and we've learned that from watching the likes of Bubba Watson, power hitters, more efficient golfers. Even Tiger Woods, before he went into the more stack and tilt golf machine move that Sean Foley taught him, before that, he was much more into his trail leg in the backswing and more into his trail leg at impact than people would imagine. He would have been close to 40% on his trail leg at impact. Makes no sense, but that's exactly what he was. These are ways to recruit power And guys are, you know, look, I'll say teaching's getting better. It's getting smarter. Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, they're getting, there is now at least a balance between quantitative and qualitative measurements. For a while, quantitative measurements were dominating. And that's ridiculous. You know, you need to have good qualitative measurements they're just as necessary as good quantitative measurements. And I would even argue they're more important. You need to have somebody who can say, that's what it looks like, okay? Empiricists. Empiricists matter. It's like, that's what it should look like, right there. And there'd be a quantitative guy going, well, you know, he was 41 there or 61 here. And, I mean, that's important for scientists. But in the now, it's about empiricism. It's like, you know, that's what it looks like.
Yeah.
And that's what it should look like.
And fewer injuries will result.
And teachers, I think, fewer injuries will result. Mm-hmm. You know, the restricted swing needs to die. It had about a 30-40 year lifespan. Mm-hmm. It lived far too long, and it did way too much damage to the game to golfers.
All right. Well, let's talk about rivalries, which, you know, we could probably do a two-parter or four-parter because it's such a big part of the history of the game. But, you know, as a taking-off point, you know, Rory McIlroy and Brooks Koepka look like they have a very promising rivalry going on right now. And, you know, we saw Brooks beat Rory in Memphis at the WGC, and then we saw Rory win at the Tour Championship and win the FedEx Cup as a result against Brooks when they were both in the final pairing. And, of course, Rory went on to win Player of the Year, which was controversial. And because of that, there's some heat there. Although Brooks has, I think, been gracious about it, he did say when asked about it, look, I've been out here 5 years. You know, I've won four majors. Rory hasn't won one in that time. And, you know, you addressed that and thought it was somewhat disrespectful. I would disagree and only say I thought he was being territorial in a way that a guy who thinks that he's on the throne would be. But how do you assess, let's just talk about the properties of their rivalry. Is it a good rivalry? It hasn't really quite happened to the extent of some of the classic ones over time, but is it got the properties for it?
Well, first of all, I want to say this. When Brooks made his comments, mm-hmm. and people would say, oh, I applaud his honesty. It's great that we have somebody who's being honest. Of course, you want people to be honest, but you also want them to be correct, okay? I don't applaud honesty when it's massively incorrect. It's like, that's ignorance. Brooks wants to say he's only been out here 5 years. Brooks turned pro in 2012. Mm-hmm. Okay, from 2012, so from 2012 to the moment when Brooks said that, he had played in 179 events, and Rory had played in 180. Rory had finished in the top 10 99 times. Brooks had finished in the top 10 59 times, and they had both won four major championships. So Rory, if Rory were inclined to take the route that Brooks did, could have mm-hmm. said, you're right, there is no rivalry because I'm massively more consistent than you are. We have the same number of majors, and I kill you when it comes to consistency.
Well, he didn't say it, but you just did, so that feeds.
But Rory could have said that. And Rory knows that. Trust me, Rory would know that
sure.
because Rory's a student of the game, and he's well aware. But Rory handled it beautifully. He was like, I didn't need to be told I hadn't won any mm-hmm. majors in 5 years. But if you want to cherry pick a period of time or a year, you know, and choose to hang your hat on that, I suppose you could do that. But my issue with it was disrespectful to Rory, and it was just wrong. It mm-hmm. wasn't there clearly is a rivalry, whether or not he admits it or not. There is a rivalry. There's very few people in the game that can play golf anywhere close to Rory as consistently as Rory. And Brooks got him a few times. Mm-hmm. That makes it a rivalry. And then Rory came back and got him at the Tour Championship. So there is a rivalry, and it's fun and it's good. And listen, as much as I don't like what Brooks said, I don't like the fact that it was wrong and disrespectful, the fact that it was wrong and disrespectful, it's okay to have a good guy and a bad guy in the game of golf. Mm-hmm. You know, that's okay. And it does add fuel to the rivalry. So if that were Brooks's intent, I don't know that it was, but if it were his intent,
it worked that
good
way,
for him. Then, you know, I'll say good for if it was his intent, because it's made the rivalry, it's made the next time that they play more interesting.
What do you think about the concept of rivalries in golf? I mean, we all talk about
rare.
Rare.
Very rare.
I would agree. And there's still this sense that, oh, for a great era to happen, there has to be a rivalry. And I think sometimes it's antithetical to golf that there be a sort of rivalry that's comparable to other sports, because the real opponent in golf is the golf course, at least in medal play. If there was a lot of match play, I think you'd see a lot more rivalries.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, that's missing the obvious. The greatest era of golf, at least in terms of entertainment value, I think you could argue was the Tiger Woods era. And there was no rivalry then. Mm-hmm. There was zero. Tiger never had a rival. His rival were history books. Short term.
He had Duval and he had Vijay, I think, just for a two-year period with David and a one-year period for Vijay. Now, I know that doesn't
mean, you know, he was massively better than both of them. You know, I mean, Duval got him for a period of time, but Duval only won one major, and it was a brief period of time. And Vijay Singh got him in 2004 when Tiger Woods was
transitioning.
People had good year. Mark O'Meara had a good year in 98. Tiger was changing. I'm not taking anything away.
No, I understand.
Because you got to step up and play. But he had a good year in 98. Tiger was changing his golf swing. Vijay Singh had a great year in 2004. Tiger was changing his golf swing. In 2008, Padraig Harrington and Sergio Garcia played great. Tiger was gone. So, I mean, I'm not taking anything away from those performances. But when somebody who is demonstrably better than everybody else checks out for a while, it allows everybody else to just compete, and the best of those will come to the forefront. So, you know, in the history of the game, there hasn't been 10 rivalries that you could really point to that say that these were legitimate rivalries. I mean, just since World War II, we could sit here and count them, and just, you know, there was Hogan and Snead. There was Palmer and Nicklaus. There was Nicklaus and Trevino.
Watson.
There was Nicklaus and Watson. That's four.
I think when we talk about the parameters of what makes up a rivalry, I think it'd be almost variable from not person to person, but certainly.
I don't.
Well, I'm more in your camp, but I'm saying a lot of people feel like if it's a short-term moment when some player who's inferior to an all-time great, as happened with Jack, and they compete and actually beat that all-time great for a period of time, that's a rivalry. You could say it doesn't match up, as you did with the Tiger example, in terms of the body of work. It doesn't match up. But for that moment, when David Duval was at his peak in 98 and 99, he won 29 times, or I think it was
13
times in 29 events, and Tiger won once in that period.
But again,
and then Tiger went crazy.
Again, Tiger was changing his golf swing in 98, 99.
He was. I'm only saying, though, there was definitely a feeling like, hey, is David Duval actually
He
better
wasn't
than
his rival at the end of 99. He wasn't his rival
he
in
wasn't,
2000.
He wasn't
his rival in 2001.
I'm with you, but I'm just saying, during that period of about 8 months, there was a real sense of, wow, let's watch these guys. It's interesting. And I think the same thing occurred with Vijay. It's not a classic rivalry in terms of over a decade, but even Arnold and Jack didn't really match up that many times.
No, they didn't. I mean, when I say it was a rivalry, they were as much a rivalry in business.
Well, that's what I'm also talking about. Do we include those factors? Personality difference, style differences. Those are the things.
They got off to such a great start.
It did.
After that, it took a while for a rivalry for Jack to come along, and it was Trevino.
Yeah.
Trevino got the better of him. You know, who got the better of Jack? Trevino. Who got the better of Jack? Watson, and that was amazing that they did.
It was amazing.
And the fact that Jack handled it so well. So those I think we can agree, were legitimate rivalries. Palmer, you're right, it didn't really materialize much on the golf course.
But there were these micro rivalries that I think if you break it down, and I know you're familiar with these whole things, it makes it, I mean, like Ken Venturi and Arnold Palmer, when they were in the mid-50s coming up, a lot of people felt like Ken Venturi was the guy with the most talent, and Arnold Palmer was kind of a brutish player who wouldn't have as much game, and yet, and they knocked heads. And 58 Masters, Arnold edged him out, and then he edged out in the 60s. Then he became Arnold Palmer, and suddenly Ken Venturi was definitely eclipsed.
Yeah.
But there was an interesting moment time there.
Those were like campfires, and Watson and Nicklaus were bonfires.
Who's to say that Koepka and Rory aren't a campfire?
Well, if neither of them play well at the right time, that's the thing that.
But at the moment, we're talking about as a rivalry. So that's my only point is that.
Well, at the moment, it's a bonfire. I mean, it's a rivalry. It's game on. Because I,
It's such a short term. We're only talking about 9 or 10 months.
No, they're both in their prime.
Okay.
They're both in the prime of their career. They could both. Rory is going to continue to play great golf. He's projecting forward.
I'm with you.
3, 4, 5 years.
But you would have said this about David Duval in the middle of 1999 as well. Tiger Woods and David Duval are both in their prime. They're incredible. They've both been number one. This is going to be great. And it fizzled. So I'm just saying that's possible too.
David got injured. And there's, you know, lots of discussion of it. If David were here, you know, maybe he would tell us why he thinks he got injured. I think he got injured because he was in the gym trying to keep up with Tiger Woods. That's my take on it. I think he, you know, Tiger Woods forced his hand. And I think that's part. I think Rory has already been in the gym, changed his philosophy about how to train. He's not going to get injured. I don't see Brooks Koepka changing his golf swing much. I don't see him messing around with it much. I think it's likely that Brooks will continue to play some pretty darn good golf if he doesn't hurt himself in the gym further. You know, the gym is a dangerous place. When you see a guy in the prime of his life have a knee injury, you know, again, it's like you start looking at the loads that some of these guys are taking. You look online, you see the things they're doing, you think, man.
Well, Tiger was sort of the forerunner. He definitely was in the gym.
Well, they should
to
all,
an aggressive amount.
They should have all learned from Tiger what not to do. Because, you know, do you want Tiger's body? No. That gym didn't help Tiger Woods play better golf. You'll never get me to think that. Never, ever. Tiger played, he swung faster, hit it further when he was built like Bubba Watson. You know, the minute he started looking like Brooks Koepka, he didn't swing as fast, you know, and he started getting injured. So it's like, you'll never convince me that the gym helped Tiger Woods. Now, it may have helped his image, that he looked like an athlete. So it may have helped promote golf. It may have helped golf look more like a sport. It may have helped Tiger's marketability if he never, ever needed it. But it didn't help his golf.
Right.
Matter of fact, it probably hurt his golf.
I think the gym in moderation or the gym in a more sophisticated way would have helped him. I think he just overdid it.
Sure. Yeah. I think he was training poorly.
Yeah. But there were a lot of under-the-radar rivalries over the year. I mean, for example, you know, Babe Diedrichsen and Louise Suggs. That was really a heated rivalry.
Yeah.
You know, and nobody was watching. You know, it was in the 50s, and women's golf was not really on the radar, but those are two all-time greats who won.
Two of my favorite swings ever.
Yeah, there you go. And you know the swing. And Louise Suggs was really underrated, and she had a problem with Babe because Babe was the star, and she had some issues about the way Babe sort of interpreted the rules and to the point of accusing her of cheating. So that added more, you know, in terms of the intensity of their matchup, whether a lot of people were watching or not, that was a rivalry. And there have been a few like that. And I would imagine Hogan and Nelson was a great rivalry because they grew up together. And Ben grew up feeling slighted because, you know, Byron was sort of the favorite of the local community. And he got some advantages. And, you know, he got the junior membership. And Ben Hogan didn't get it. And then Byron had all that early success. And Ben was struggling, and you almost feel like after Nelson retired, or, you know, essentially retired, Hogan was still chasing him, you know, and that's one of the reasons he played so well after. And he won 13 tournaments the year after Nelson won 18. So anyway, you know all these things. And the point being, these rivalries, again, I'm sort of talking about out of both ends of my side of my mouth because I don't really believe in the idea that a player is thinking about his opponent that much when he's playing a tournament. He's thinking about dealing with the shot and the golf course. And so the rivalry becomes incidental. But at the same time, there are properties that to the public make those matchups very compelling. I was going to ask you, growing up, you must have had some rivals and some rivalries.
And you know,
through junior golf, through college, through pro golf, they were personal to you. And certainly at the college level, you were talking about the stratosphere of college golf. Did it help you to think in terms of rivalries as far as performance, or was it counterproductive?
Yeah, they do. They make you go to the range longer. They make you work out. You know, they make you, you know, work on your short game. Absolutely, I had rivals. I wanted to beat everybody on my team. You know, probably my biggest rival on the team probably had two, Mark Brooks and Paul Thomas. You know, you wanted to beat them. You know, Mark was a tough guy to beat. I mean, Mark was a hell of a player and went on to have a hell of a career on the PGA Tour. But yeah, I mean, everybody has those kinds of things. I mean, rivalries, those kind of rivalries, yes, they exist everywhere.
Sure.
And I had them. I still have them. You know, I've played on the PGA Tour Champions. You go out there, and I finished 1 week, and Bob Estes sent me a text. He was like, "I birdied 17. I ended up beating you by one."
Yeah.
And you know, it's like I'm trying to beat Bob. Bob's trying to beat me.
We
have a little rivalry.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, we want to. I like Bob. I love him. And you know, but he wants to beat me. I want to beat him. You know, when I was out on the tour, I wanted to beat Cameron Beckman and Jimmy Walker, only because I was in San Antonio. They were in San Antonio. They were buds with my best bud. And you know, I mean, Jimmy Walker kind of took it to another level. But yeah, you have those rivalries. Everybody does. But golf in general only cares about what the stars are doing and superstars. And occasionally it comes along where these two superstars are sort of equally matched, who are sort of incompatible in terms of their personalities. And that's what the sport has right now. At least it has right now at this moment, it's a rivalry. And will it continue to build? Who knows? You know, the game just, we don't get, you know, Sampras, Agassi, you know.
Well,
get Djokovic, Federer.
They're playing against each other.
Right, they play against each other. We just don't get that. I mean, there's so many variables in the game of golf. That's why these, you know, I mean, skins games try to do it and so forth. But and it's one of the things that's good about the FedEx Cup, though, is that it gets the best players playing together. So you'll get, at the end of this year, there's a pretty darn good chance, as we're sitting here, at the end of this season, I should say, that Brooks and Rory will be paired together in the FedEx Cup. They were this past year, and they probably will be next year.
We'll wait for that, yeah.
That'll be must-watch TV.
Of course.
That'll be must-watch.
What I was getting at, too, though, regardless of whether it was high-profile, like you said, people care about the stars, and you're living kind of a private battle with your peers. And yet, did it help you to think about, I got to beat Mark Brooks while you're playing? Or were you thinking about, I got to birdie this hole, I got to par this hole, and then we'll add them up at the end and see how I did against Brooks? In other words, is it counterproductive to try to play the man? Because Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus used to say we used to get too much into playing each other.
I remember one time our coach made Mark Brooks and I qualify for the team, and we were both first-team All-Americans. And it was preposterous that he would make us qualify. And he told us there's only one spot for the team, right? So either Brooks or I are not going to make it. And so we're going down the first hole, 72-hole qualifying. We're going down the first hole, and Brooks looks at me and he goes, let's blow everybody away and then tie and then see who he picks. And I was like, you know, let's do it. Get after it. You better play well. And so sure enough, 72 holes were 10 ahead. And we get to the last hole, and I hit it like 12 feet, and Mark hits it 8 feet, and we're tied. And I'm like, I'm not going to purposely miss this putt, because if I do, that son of a
he's going to make it.
And
that's good.
So I missed my putt trying to make it, but I missed it. And I kind of looked at Brooks, and I was waiting for him to look at me like, "Don't worry." And he was in full grind mode. He was plumb bobbing. He was giving the 360. And he gets in there and he hits his putt, and it hits and lips out and hangs on a lip. And I'm like, you rotten SOB. You were trying to make that.
Uh-huh.
And he was like, well, I'm not going to say I was. I'm not going to say I wasn't. Anyway, we tied. I think the coach took us both. But
that's a good one.
But, you know, I think we brought the best out in each other. You go out and grind. I want to beat Mark by 10. He wants to beat me by 10. And you get better. I mean, those little mini rivalries are great. They're great. They're fun. They're great. They're interesting. They make the game interesting. So I don't know if we'll ever get the sound to this, but the next time Rory and Brooks play, both of them will be more invested in the outcome, because Rory wants to be Brooks and Brooks wants to be Rory. They want to show, you know, I'm the man up in here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what I promise you. They'll be more invested. Not that they're not ever fully invested. Well, if you believe Brooks, he's never fully invested unless it's a major. But if it won't be a major where you're in the next
event. No, I think Brooks, for better or worse, has laid down the gauntlet so that he has to perform now, too, every time they play, not just at majors. He can't, I don't think, say, you know, hey, Rory's not even in my category, and then go to a regular event and finish 20th, and Rory finishes second or wins it, and act like it didn't matter. No, every time they're
right.
Well, every time they play together now, I think it's a referendum on who's better.
Well, he's got to get healthy first of all.
You know, that's a big deal.
You know, by all accounts, it's going to be 3 months till he comes back, which means he's not going to be at the President's Cup, which means Tiger has 5 picks, not 4 picks.
Yeah, we'll probably see Tiger.
And why is that? You know. You tell me who injures their knee. How many other people injured their knee? How many other people spent that much time in the gym? I say the two are correlated.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, just historically, what is your favorite rivalry and why?
Jack and Lee and Jack and Watson are, you know, it's tough to choose between the two. There's the video of Lee throwing the snake at Jack, and then Lee beat Jack in that playoff at Marion in 71. But Tom getting Jack at the 77 Masters, getting Jack at the 77 Open, and then getting him again at the 82 U.S. Mm-hmm. Open, and Jack saying what he said to him on the end of, you know, after they putted out in a nice way, you know,
you got me again,
you got me again, USOB, and this, you know, and then the exchanges they had at you know, Jack, Tom tells this story that Jack made the putt on the last green at the Open Championship in 77. And Tom had told Bruce, his caddy. No, it wasn't Bruce, his caddy, because Bruce didn't caddy
for there.
It was Alfie Files. He told Alfie, he's going to make it. He's going to make it. This is Jack Nicklaus. He's going to make it. And he made it, right? And Tom said it was in the whole way. And he said, I'm waiting to hit my putt. And the crowd is going nuts.
Yeah.
Going nuts.
2.5, 3 footer.
Right. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you know, I'm kind of waiting for this crowd and they're still not quieting down. And he said, so finally it's like, I'm just going to hit this putt even with the crowd yelling. He says, I'm just getting into my putt. And he goes, and I kind of look up and I see Jack with both arms in the air.
Uh-huh.
And he was like a conductor in an orchestra because he took both arms in the air and then he brought them down. And as he brought them down, the octave went to silent.
Wow.
And he goes, it was one of the classiest things. And he said, that's Jack. And then Tom just knocked it in the hole. And Jack put his arm around him. And I defy you to look at the picture of them walking off that green with Jack's arm around Watson and tell me who won. You can't.
Yeah.
You cannot tell me who won because Jack looks just as happy for Tom as Tom looks happy.
Mm-hmm.
And that golf will never get that rivalry again because it's just unlikely that two superstars will come along with so much respect for the traditions of the game, with such tradition for golf, with such tradition and respect and understanding for each other. It's just so incredibly rare to have two very mature men come along with that kind of astuteness, respect, intelligence, and respect for one another.
I do see, though, in this younger generation, a real camaraderie and guys waiting to congratulate guys after they win. So if you saw, let's say, Jordan Spieth gets his game back to that level it was, and he's coming down the stretch with Justin Thomas.
Well, it could happen there because those two
they do have
meet
a lot
all the criteria that I just, you know, check. I mean, you got steeped in tradition with Justin Thomas, raised by his father, who's sharp as he can be about the game, raised right, as people would say where I'm from. Jordan Spieth, same thing, raised right. You know, so these guys have real high golf IQs, but a sense of comportment that is consistent with the traditions of the game.
But Turnberry was magical. Well, I will say I love both your examples, and I'm a huge Trevino fan. But having talked to Lee about his play against Jack, he had ultimate respect for Jack as the best player. And while he knew that when he was putting good, he was really hard to beat by anybody, probably ever, he always looked at it as, look, I got nothing to lose here. He's better than me, but he's got to know he's supposed to win. And I'm here thinking, you know, whatever happens, it's gravy. And that was a psychological ploy and advantage that he used to help him relax. Watson, on the other hand, I think felt like, and maybe he got Jack a little later in life, but Jack was still tremendous, obviously, felt like, you know, I'm the best player. And it was more of a direct challenge. In a way, I thought it was a greater achievement because he took Jack on as an equal and didn't try to act like, you know, if I lose, it's okay. It was like, no, I'm number one and I'm defending it and I'm showing who's the best here. And it was a more bold kind of thing. Maybe that's a function of personality, but I always felt Watson was the guy who took on the full weight of Jack Nicklaus and beat him. And that was really impressive.
He did. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, when did Jack ever play better than he played in the 77 Open? And,
yeah.
you know, by all accounts, he had won his fifth U.S. Open in 82. You know, but it took arguably the greatest or one of the greatest ball strikers of all time in Trevino to clip Jack.
Yeah.
And it took arguably the greatest scrambler mm-hmm. of all time to beat Jack. So that's what it took. And those men... Those two are as tenacious and very sharp. Trevino is a very sharp, very, very bright man, and so is Watson. So it took extreme intelligence, extreme understanding, extreme discipline. In the foreword to Tom Watson's book, Lee Trevino writes it, Tom Watson's instruction book that he wrote back in the 80s. And in the foreword, Lee Trevino tells a story about driving in when he was a star in 71, 72, to play the Pro-Am at Jackie Gleason Inverary Classic. And all the on the road in, you have to pass the practice bunker. And he said, I'm driving in, and there's this guy over there hitting shots out of this practice bunker, bunker shots, one after the other. Lee Trevino drives in, goes in, changes, goes to the range, warms up, plays the Pro-Am, which takes 5 hours, practices afterwards, gets in his car, and drives out. Same guy is still in that bunker, hitting bunker shots, and Trevino's like, oh, who is that guy? Yeah. He's been hitting bunker shots for 8 hours. Who is that? And he looks over and he's like, Tom Watson. And
remember
he's like,
that
I don't,
name.
He was like, I don't know who that guy is, but that guy's going to make it.
Yeah.
Now, so back to so that sort of tenacity Trevino had, 60 to 66, all he did was hit golf balls on a driving range. So it took people of that intelligence, that tenacity, and that kind of talent to topple Jack down. And if it weren't for them, you know, Tom took three, maybe four from Jack, and Trevino took two. So you're talking about 5-6 that these, it took colossal, monumental Hall of Fame talent to take those away from Jack. So those rivalries are very, very rare. Those were great rivalries because they had such great respect for one another.
Yes, well said.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, Randall.
Enjoyed it. It's,
as always.
It's always fun to talk rivals. It's one of those topics that everybody has an anecdote and everybody has an opinion on. So it's always fun. Hopefully we'll get another great rivalry this year. We'll get to see.
We shall see. And you've set it up in a way that makes it more likely in my mind that it'll continue on. So thank you. All right. Till next time. Thanks for listening.
With spring Black Friday deals at the Home Depot, you can give your lawn or garden beds a pop of color and protection. Right now, get a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch, 5 bags for just $10. Help your soil retain moisture longer with color that lasts up to 12 months. Shop spring Black Friday deals for a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch, 5 bags for just $10 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. Color selection varies by store. Limit 60 bags per customer while supplies last.